Welcome back to the Jack of No Trades podcast. This is a podcast about people and what they do. I'm your host, Michelle McAllister, and today we are talking all about the power of play, the power of discernment, and also listening to the power of I want to. Kiara Maya is an entrepreneur with a spiritual kick and also a good friend of the podcast. She shares so many good little nuggets that I just kind of want to dig right in. So Kiara, take it away. What is it that you do?
I always feel like a deer in headlights when I get asked that question. What do you do? And I've been better now saying, well, I'm an entrepreneur. I do quite a few things. And so currently the way I answer that question is, yeah, I'm an entrepreneur. I own my own business. It's a spiritual consulting and clarity coaching business. I also act and produce. And I almost said direct. That was funny. Nope, not yet. But I act and I produce. And I also work part-time for a nonprofit that I helped found that facilitates youth development through sports. So that's my spiel when I give it to people.
That's a good spiel. I usually, when people tell me, like ask me what do I do for a living, I say, what day of the week are you talking about? Because it changes.
Exactly. Which hat am I wearing today? But yeah, I think entrepreneur kind of encompasses that. I work for myself. I have since I was young, even though I did work in the service industry, hospitality, right? Waitressing, serving. I did a lot of fine dining growing up since I was like 14. But that was always, you know, a day job, so to speak. And mm-hmm. I was always running hustles on the side, that kind of thing.
Well, what did you, when you were a kid and you're like, when I grow up, I'm going to be blah, blah, blah. What was the thing that came out of your mouth?
It's so funny. I've reflected on this quite a bit over the years because it strikes me as odd only that I ended up doing it was that when I was about 10 years old, I found this article that proves this. There was an article in our youth, like our elementary school, like school newsletter that somebody interviewed me when I was like 10 or 11. And it asked me this question, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I was like, I want to be an actor, aww. You know? And so I had like found that when I was maybe 30. No, I guess I was 20, 27. And I'd found that article and I was so like taken aback by it. I found it in my scrapbook stuff. And I was so taken aback by it because I was like, oh, wow. Like I ended up doing what I was doing. And then I remembered that I had found that article one time before when I was, I guess that was when I found it. Yeah, I was a 27 and I found it and I was like, this proves, because I had been thinking about wanting to be an actor. At that time, I had just graduated college and I had graduated with an interior design degree and an art history degree. And I had gone to Europe and lived in Europe and I had traveled and I'd come home to where I had grew up to be with my family for a while. And I was like, what am I doing with my life? I tried to be a designer. I successfully did, you know, design a few homes for friends that were building homes at the time. And I looked at my life and I was like, this is not what I'm supposed to be doing. And I asked myself, what did I want for myself when I was 10? I like asked myself that randomly. I was like, what do I want for myself? Because I felt like that age, and I've read some things since that have proven like 10, 11, that is an age somehow before you're, and I wanted to say corrupted, but somehow before you're, you know, influenced. That you really do know who you are and what you want. And so I remembered, I want to be an actor. And then I found that article. And I was like, oh my God, so that's trippy. So I went on that journey. That was how that went. But yeah, at that time, I think I've always wanted to be an artist or an actor or something interesting. There was a time where I thought I wanted to be a professional athlete, but I am too slow and too small. So that didn't work.
I'm similar. I'm like, I'm athletic, but there's a level there. And I think the only thing that my doctor ever told me or told my parents was like, they're like, she would make a good gymnast when I was like little, because I was just so petite. I could throw her on a balance beam or something. She'd be fine up there. I'm like, I guess. Did not last.
No, me neither. Yeah.
So wait, I mean, you've always been drawn to like more artistic endeavors, which I mean, same. But why did you initially start with interior design? What was it about that stood out to you?
I was such a funny young person because I when I reflect back, because I just decided that. I remember I was driving on the freeway up in Humboldt County, California, where I'm from. There's literally no people, so there was no cars. It was late at night. I was driving back from, I think, Eureka South on the 101 South, and I was in my Volvo, my 1986 Volvo. It was like a tank, and I had this flash, like, what do I want to? I was in high school, and I was like, what do I want to go to college for? Like, I want to decide, and I just decided in that moment. I was like, interior design. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to be a designer. I couldn't tell you where that came from. Now, looking back, maybe I had had other previous conversations, but that's the way memory works, right? You like fold it into itself and whatever. But I do remember clearly, though, at least my recollection, that I had that moment where I was like, that's what I'm going to do. And I was such a funny young person, I say, because I just, then I would just decide things and then you couldn't stop me. Like, that was what I was going to do. You couldn't convince me otherwise. But I look back on it now and I think, yeah, I was always really interested in art, and I grew up in a house that was unfinished. I grew up poverty basically, and so I my but in a different, we can get into that maybe another time, but I grew up in poverty. You kind of know this, I think. Like, my we didn't have insulation, we didn't have drywall, it was the plywood box. My parents never got it together to, put the money where it needed to be, to it just whatever money management or priorities, I don't know, they just never finished it. So it was really cold in the winters, and it was like, there was a plywood floor, you'd get splinters in your feet if didn't wear shoes. And it was a wonderful home, but I think that might have influenced it, because like, no closets, no doors. It sounds really extreme. I wish someone could see into my mind and see it. It was so definitely livable, but I think that might have, looking back, it might have influenced that I wanted to create spaces in homes, in residences that were beautiful and functional, and that probably was why. But I wasn't aware of that at the time, I don't think. I just decided.
At least for me and when I was young at that age, and I was like 18, and they're like, "What do you want to do for your life?" And I'm like, "I want to go into the arts." And I just was so clueless about everything. One thing I didn't anticipate was the amount of fear that I had presenting my first like piece of artwork. I was a studio art major, so literally like painting,
Oh,
drawing, that kind of stuff.
yeah. Oh, wow.
And I'd done these th things before, so I don't know, like nothing about it seemed that, the habits of it were there, but the presentation of it and having it critiqued and having to talk about like, but why did you choose to do this when so much of it was just happenstance? I was just like, well, I don't know, it felt like a good idea at the right time, so I decided to use this color. There wasn't any thesis behind it. It was just that's what I decided to do, and you had to kind of. In my view, at the time, I was like, I have to just kind of like bullshit my way through whatever that is. 'Cause at times I was like, I don't know. It seemed like a good idea. I liked it. It's pretty. Did you have
Yeah.
any like blocks that you weren't expecting when you first started your first few steps as an artist? 'Cause I mean, no matter what you've done, you've always been very artistic.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I was relating to so much of what you're saying in a couple different ways. Let me sort it out in my brain. It's so interesting to hear you tell that story, because for me, it was when I started acting. Like I said, I had graduated. And I was like, I know I want to be an actor. And I'd done, since I was in elementary school, I had done whatever I could. That was a small town, but like anytime any of the Missoula Children's Theater, like traveling, like theater come, I would always, I'd always audition. I would always participate in any acting stuff. And then I went away from it for a long time. So when I came back as an actor, it was one that my very first class, for instance. And I would shake. Like, I was so nervous, and I realized pretty early on, like, oh, this matters so much to me. I had put that in there, but I was really relating to your story, because when I started furthering my education in terms of college, my first few design classes in college, I just like the assignment was, under interior design one, like understand these design principles, pattern, make a board that reflects a room. And I just put things together. I had no, like you said, thesis behind it. I had no sense behind it. I didn't, nothing was invested. My worth and who I was, my taste even, I was just completing the assignment. And it was satisfying and it was fun and it was artistic and it was creative and I felt good about it. And so when I put that up for presentation, I wasn't even aware that people were judging it. My lovely interior design teacher, I can't even see her face, but I remember the sentiment of it was like, she was encouraging. Like I ended up going to junior college and just took these classes so they would transfer when I wanted to transfer into university. And so she was very encouraging. There was a certification process for interior design there, but I wasn't going to go through that. But anyway, she was very encouraging, and so she was like, "Okay, this is great. Yep, you did pattern." But then later, when I was reflecting on it, I was like, "Oh, that's an ugly ass room." That room that I put out, but I didn't care in terms of like it didn't have. I wasn't yet fusing my sensibility as a designer or an identity as a designer, and I recognize actually just now I put it together that when I, as I got up to upper division classes and I started to call myself a designer and I started to identify with that, it became more and more difficult. It became more and more scary to have my work critiqued. And I don't know about you in art, I would be so interested to hear what you say, but I think I've said this to you before. Interior design critiques made any other criticism that I was going to get from any other place in my life, like cake. They would shred your shit. Like when I remember starting that program and they were like, they're all interior designers and architects. So they literally said to us, "You're our competition. We are going to steal your ideas. This is why we
Jesus.
teach." Oh yeah, it was so it was so weirdly cutthroat. I feel like someone should put like a show together for it because they were like, this is why we're here. You are students, and we want to make you quit essentially, like because you're our competition, so to speak. I think it was a little kinder than that, but they were being realistic too. They were like, many of you won't go on to be designers, so we can't really take you seriously. Like this is not a profession that people actually succeed in, which is whatever framework, maybe every mathematician and maybe every department kind of frames things that way. But so it was really competitive. And so they had no mercy, but they were really good at what they did, and they were teaching you because you can't, I mean, especially with interior design and design in general, right? Function, you put a product out there, I think of like the Samsungs or the iPhones. It's like if it damages somebody, if you don't design an ADA bathroom the way that it is, and that handicapped person can't get into that resident, into that commercial space, that's on you. As the designer, like you'll lose jobs. So they were, I think preparing us for an industry that also is a luxury industry. Interior design is not a needed, architects are, engineers are, but interior designers, like artists, are they're seen as dispensable kind of. It's a luxury industry. So I think there was just a lot of prep, but yeah, you can't, you couldn't put you I could I don't think I ever put up anything where my professor was like, "Wow, that's a good design." I think it was always like, what were you thinking over here? Like you said, like what were you thinking? And then you had to straight up justify it because your identity was on your line. So I wish I would have held on to a little more of the not identifying and staying in the curiosity and creativity of design, because it ended up being weight on my worth and my ego probably and my self-esteem. And it really tore me down a lot. And then when I went into acting, I transitioned and it became the opposite. I'm like, this is what I really want to do. And then from the get-go, I was already in that same space of this is my identity and I have to succeed. And for me, I don't know for you, but like as a recovering perfectionist, it's like if you're in that pressure place, you can't be creative.
No, it hampers down all sense of fluidity and creativity and freedom. Like it, you just feel chained down because you're like, well, I can't mess this up. Like
Exactly.
it, for me, it was the opposite. Like I, well, not the opposite, but I'm still realizing exactly how sensitive I can be with random things of people that I neither know, like, or care about, where back then, like the smallest critique. And I mean, a lot of my work was like, I was a student and I was figuring out a lot of stuff and I was throwing myself into mediums I'd never done before. And I never
So
held
cool.
myself to be like, even sketching, like I would sketch all the time, but I didn't really care if I was anatomically correct. So I'm okay with the fact that I tended to like lengthen limbs a little bit longer than they should be. I'm okay with the fact that I didn't get like the perspective completely correct all the time. Because to me, like the artists that I loved, even though, yes, I understand they were like classically trained and perfectionists as well and beautiful, but like the Picassos, like the ones who would do things that are a little bit more of expressive in nature, that wasn't Matisse. It wasn't something that was like, this has to look photorealistic. That's just not the artwork I make. I never connected to that. So to go into that and then just be torn to shreds, because yeah, I knew I'm not as good as the person next to me who can make this beautiful, eyeball sketch look like
Yes.
an actual human eye. Like it looked amazing. And then there's mine. It looks like,
Yes.
a kid next to it, if that's the rubric you're going to go off of. But it was really difficult for me in the very, especially in the beginning. It took years to build up that muscle and to not care. And there's still a lot of things where I'm like, no one cares. Even if they're giving you critiques, no one cares. They're going to think about this for
Right.
5 minutes and they're going to go away. No one's going to care.
I was reflecting because to do design, you have to go through all those level one art classes, right? You take drawing, you take painting, or at least you have your options because it is art. And I remember again, my art, I think it was whatever the, I don't know, art one, it's like where you have that sketchbook and they're teaching you about these different mediums. I remember feeling like a child in the best way possible. That freedom of like, oh, you want me to shred this book and make this? And I would spend hours. This is when I got to university level. And it was like, I would just spend hours in the studio art classes. I would just like smoke some weed and just go to town on a painting. You know what I mean? And I would just like, but I would also like just be so free to make that assignment, whatever it was that I thought was like, interesting. And again, really quickly, it started to become, as I got into the upper divisions of art, that thing of like comparison, right? That thing of seeing that I wasn't as good in whatever way the measurement of that class, right? Like drawing, like and trying to get things more photorealistic, as you said, really pinged me because it was like, oh, once I started to learn the principles of drawing, for instance, and I was like, oh, you can. Either is a there's a system, you do your grid and then you just focus. And I have a good eye in terms of it was training my right art is training your eye to see. You know, like you're training your eye to look at what's actually there, not to like, oh, trees are green. No, they're not. You know what I mean? Depending on the light, looking at light, like using light and shadow, and when I started to understand those principles, then it became about the time. If I could put it, just became a perfectionist trigger. If I could put more time in, just give me more time, which then made it so that I wasn't always completing assignments because or everything was just dying off. And so I just really resonated with what you said there, and also that the sensitivity of it all. Like, I think that that is, I don't know if you get this, but like, it's such an interesting paradox to be an actor because you're putting your own self out there and you're getting you the potential to be paid for this profession is to utilize your sensitivity, but you have to go through so many times when you have to have the thickest skin in the world. And like, and I'm not like complaining. I'm just saying, like, wow, what a paradox. How tough it is.
It is. I mean, I've only taken a few classes. I've never done acting professionally, so I have a limited range of experience to pull from. But it's a very different workforce in that you have to be so incredibly vulnerable, yet so incredibly thick-skinned. You have to turn that on like you're flipping on and off a switch, because the minute they call cut, if they give you some feedback, you got to be like, okay, this is it's just about the work. It's not about you.
Separating the art from the person. And that is one thing that I will say. I think I've said this to you before too. So this might be just a repeat conversation for you, Michelle. But for the podcast listeners, maybe not. I don't know. But yeah, I remember the benefit of interior design, how wove into my current life in terms of expression of art in acting is they did teach you when you put your, it was like my professor was a Japanese man and head of the department, and he would say, like, once you put your, because we would do it back then on boards, you know, like you would actually put your board up on the wall and everyone would look at it. And it's like, once you put your board up, it is its own thing now. It lives and it is getting judged, you know, it is getting critiqued. And you're gonna have to go in and fix those things, but that is that. And he made it extend, he extended that out to say, like, because when you design a building, or you design an apartment complex, or you design a club, or you design a restaurant, or you design a residence home, you're going to design it, you're going to hand that to the architect, and it's going to become something else. And you have to make sure that your design is so integral, meaning like it has so much, your essence of what you were trying to get at is at least there, that that will live on, that that's what's going to live on. But things are going to change. So you have to be like, that it's going to live on without you. And so from the very get-go, like it has to be there. And so I recognize the correlation when I would start getting acting critiques, when people would give you directions, basically notes, you know, it was like, or in classes, it's like, I could do that thing, not always perfectly or well even, but I had that training of like, oh, they're not talking about me personally. They're talking about what I just did, which is the art. And I think that saved me a little bit of room, a little bit of maybe, or, you know, save me a little
Grace.
bit of tears sometimes. Yeah.
Well, I think, especially when you're talking about art, like film art, you know, we both work in different aspects of production, and the fun thing that I am starting to really enjoy a lot more is the fact that no matter what you put out, if it's not the final edit or the final, if you're not the editor or the finisher or somebody like that, whatever you put out is going to go through and somebody else's lens, and it's gonna get tweaked just a little bit. You know, if you put out your best performance, depending on how they cut it, it could be completely different from what you were envisioning what that scene was going to look like. But you're like, hey, okay, that's it's a different lens. It's one removed from you or two removed from you. And therefore, you know, whether it's good or bad, you're like, well, it's not really all me. It's a part of me. I'm a part of it. And
That's a good way to look at it.
but it's also, that's the fun of it though, right? Because it's so collaborative. At the end of it, you're like, if it's really good, you're like, wow, through all of those stages, like somebody decided to do something that tweaked it so good. Or if it has its challenges, you're like, okay, well, this is good and I can dissect that part, but that's not all you. Like, there's only so much they can critique about it that you're like, okay, well, that was my part, one part.
Well, that, and it's so interesting just to stay on the acting thing for one more moment. I'm sure we'll move on, but like, right, it's expressive, it's art, and you have no control. I mean, actors are the bottom rung, you know, and I think that that's deceiving, right? You think like you're on the screen, but you matter the least, really. I mean, it's true. When you start doing production, that was the most helpful thing I ever did as an actor, was start working production, because you see that you are so less important than you think you are if you've only just done acting, right? It's like you do all this work and you make it such a big thing, and it's the character, and it is work, and it's beautiful, but it's not, it's more, it's just a minutia in the whole process of a film or a television show or anything coming together. And so it's humbling, right? And then also there, like you said, there's so many iterations of that film getting written, and then it getting produced, and then it getting filmed, and then it getting, you know, edited. And there's so many iterations that it will be a completely different product at the end of it. And so it's like a control, right? Perfectionism has a lot to do with control. I realized like, oh, this was a good teacher for me to right. go into, because there's so little control. And in art in general and expression in general, right? You're like, we talked about before, like you're wanting to let go of control to allow creativity to move in and move through you and be a part of the process. If you're always trying to control it, that's one way to do it. And I have a degree in art history as well. And I don't know where I heard this or if I came up with it on my own. I doubt that. I doubt that I did. But I have found to adopt it is like there's no such thing as good and bad art, in my opinion. There's strong art and there's weak art.
Exactly.
And strong art will evoke a response and weak art will evoke no response. So if you're striving to create art, you're striving to make an impact on the human condition, but from a place of expression and then response. And yes, could art be as like a discourse conversation? Could it be, can it exist if it's never shared? Perhaps, but that's a dissertation, you know, because it's like, right. Does it require an audience for it to be called art? And that will, you know, spur a bunch of conversation. Okay. But I think like not in the entertainment industry as well. Anyway, I mean, if you make a film, it's that intersection between commerce and you know, art. It's like, if you make a film and nobody sees it, okay, yeah. But is it deemed, you know, worthy and successful? Yes, for you, because the process was challenging and you grew. But commercially, right? Did it sell? Did it have that measurement of metric? And I don't believe personally that is a qualifier for strong art, but it is if you're in the business of making films and movies and TV, then you need to be a part of, I believe you have to be a part of that awareness.
Yeah, it's being part of a society. You have to find some way to show your contribution, and in this society it's capitalistic, it's monetary in nature. That is just
the way it is. This is the way.
This is the way. Quoting some art right there. So you were acting and working production most recently, and then you decided to go into your, well, as far as I know, your latest endeavor. I've gotten a couple Akashic readings from you, but can you talk about a little bit that evolution? How did you decide to go into that arena?
Yeah, yeah, I did. That was one of the only things that I did not decide I was going to do in my life. I think not the only things, that was very absolute terms, but no, in terms of career path, I definitely decided, like I said, I wanted to do interior design. You know, I was like, I went to school for it. I definitely had that conscious choice of like, oh no, actually what I want to do is move to LA and pursue acting. Like, and then production, I kind of fell into, I started producing by accident, helping friends. And they were like, oh, will you produce with me? And I was said, oh, you want to, oh, they said, do you want to, what do you want to produce next? And I was like, oh, you want to produce with me? I don't know anything about producing. And they're like, that thing you just did where you set up the locations and housed us and did this whole thing. And that's producing. And I was like, oh. And then I learned, I had an incredible group of people who helped me, you know, learn about producing. But I fell into that and found that I had crossover skill sets of event planning and organization skills and leadership from being ASB president all the way to the president of my honor society in college. Like, I had those managerial skills and a lot of things that just lent itself into producing. So I've kind of fell into that. But boy, like, spiritual consulting was something that really kind of was a journey, meaning, and it still continues to be, where I'm like, is this real? Like, is this really what I'm doing in the best way? Meaning I find it to be probably the closest thing to my most obvious purpose in life. Like, it was that thing when I found it, I was like, oh my God, like, I can do this and people will pay me? Like, that's insane. 'Cause I will do this. This feels like the most fulfilling thing I've ever done in my life. You know, and acting does feel that way in terms of a process, that it makes me feel more like myself, and I feel like I learn about myself the most through that. Like but with the Akashic Record work and the way that I've continued to expand into spiritual consulting and creativity and clarity coaching is like, that feels like I would do that. I did that already. You know what I mean? I was doing that with my friends. I was like, but I just went in and started doing certifications and learning more about it because it was so fascinating to me. And so I'll break down a little bit more of how to answer your question. So the way that I came to that was I had never sought any kind of spiritual guidance outside of myself, really. Mm-hmm. Like I had never gone to any practitioners for anything. When I was young, we went to acupuncture and chiropractics, you know, some alternative medicine things. But I think my mom might have thrown tarot for us when we were young. My mom's like an old hippie. So, you know, but it wasn't anything that I like saw as in a path that would be like, I need this in my life. I grew up in the Native American church, which isn't really a church. It's like Native prayer services or teepee ceremonies where they use plant medicine, sacred peyote, and it that's their way of life. You know, it's not even like a separated thing. It's like that's spiritual and the way of life. And so I grew up that way. So I didn't have an organized religion necessarily at all. I didn't. And I wasn't part of an organized religion. And so when I, you know, left home and was seeking my own path, I didn't really have, besides the principles that I grew up in, you know, that were just, you know, a connection to creation, and you want to nurture that. And my dad, I remember, did, you know, instruct me, was like, hey, whatever it is you find, you do want to nurture and find your connection to spirit, whatever that looks like. If you want to be Buddhist, or you want to like whatever it is, just he did emphasize that, and he had, you know, very little control over what that looked like, but actually empowered, you know, all his kids to have that, though, that connection. And so I think I was looking for that, and that was a long-winded way to say that I never went to any practitioners, but I ended up finding it through a friend, the Akashic Records. So I took a friend out to dinner in downtown LA and was giving him a ride back to his truck or his car. And he said, hey, I have something to play for you. You know, it's a recording of this session I just went to with this woman, and I think you would really resonate with it. And because I'm really into quantum and I love talking, she can't tell. So I love conversations, and I was exploring, and I've always been very curious about spirituality and the universe and consciousness. And, you know, he knew that, and we were acting buddies. And so it was always this like big philosophical conversations and spiritual conversations, the way we approached acting and humanity, exploration of humanity. So he knew I would have resonance with this woman. And within the first minute, Mish, like the first 15, 20 seconds of this woman talking, something in me, which had never sparked, like I said, I didn't go to practitioners. I didn't go to like any kind of, I don't think palm readers or channelers or anything is going to, I didn't invalidate their experience or psychics or anything. I was like, it just wasn't for me. Mm-hmm. But I heard this woman speak, and something in me was like, I want to go to her. Like, oh. I want to have this experience, like, for myself. It was immediate. And I'm so grateful to him for sharing that to me, because I did. I booked a session with her, and she was an Akashic Records practitioner who ended up being a dear friend of mine and a teacher of mine. And she opened up my world to that. But prior to that, I had no knowledge of it in my consciousness about the Akashic Records. And I'll share what that is in a moment. But once I got into that experience, I realized that when I was a senior in college, senior in high school, I did my graduating research project on dreams and dreaming. And I wrote like a book, but it was not like a book. I should have pulled it out for you to show you, because it's like have I ever showed you that book? It's like, mm-hmm. It's like I made the actual book, like that was part of the project. And so the actual content wasn't really that great, but it was like, you know, 17 pages or something. It wasn't, you know, it's like a pamphlet, but I actually made the book. So I call it a book. But anyway, it was on dreaming. And I remember coming across Edgar Cayce, who's known as the sleeping prophet. This is when I was 18. And I ran it by my mom and my dad. I was like, what is the Akashic Records? Like, have you heard of this? Because Edgar Cayce in the 20s brought it to kind of Western awareness that there is this compendium of human knowledge, human existence, human. I think my mom is the one who's responded and said, like, I said, what is the Akashic Records? And she said, oh, it's the, how did she say it? It's the compendium of all information of humans or something like that.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, what? You know, and she's like, yeah, it's the record of all information. And I was like, how do you know that? And we went on a conversation. But what's weird is that, you know, I wrote that research paper. I read about Edgar Cayce. I asked both my parents. They both knew about it. And then I dropped it. Like, I never went back to it. And then all these years later, I find this woman who reads the Akashic Records. And I'm like, wait, is this? And, you know, is this the same thing? So that's how it happened. And what happened after that was I had such a profound experience with her and with this information resource that I immediately was like, I want to learn how to do this for myself. Like, I think this is what I've been seeking. I think that, you know, because I was a seeker and I put that in past tense because it's not helpful to continue to be a seeker, I've realized. But I was a seeker because you'll never find, right? You're like always seeking. But I was a seeker of information and personal growth information and spiritual information. And when I found that, I went, oh, this is a direct access into my augmented intelligence. This is a direct access into, I don't want to say a higher intelligence because I think that word is like charged in a weird way, but it definitely is a expanded and an altitude of consciousness that really is so helpful because I only have a limited viewpoint, you know, from my own experiences, and this helps to expand it. And so I just wanted to learn how to do it for myself. And I took the training to do that. And in that training, you learned how to do it for yourself and you learned how to do it for others. And at that time, I had no idea I had any other gifts, if you call them gifts. I don't know what to call them, like talents or skills in this area of helping people with their access to their own source consciousness, mm-hmm. right? Their own source consciousness and consciousnesses. And so I went in being like, we had to do all these drills, I almost said, these exercises with partners where it's like, okay, you need to know the difference between a psychic and intuitive reading and Akashic Records. You need to, and I'd sit in front of my like partner and be like, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to, I'm not psychic. I'm not going to give you any information. Like, you know, and then like, you know, they were blindfolded. Yes. And they would blindfold you, you know, so you weren't picking up just like cues and just try to get you in touch with intuitive learning and these different ways. And I would take the blindfold off and this person is like crying. And I'm like, what? Oh, maybe. And then it was less like anything about me. It was more, again, that piece of like, oh, this is helpful for you. That feels good to me. If you're taking something away from this that you like are like expressing to me that it helped you, because besides serving in restaurants, I didn't really have that like direct, like, I see you and then I help you and you're thankful and I'm grateful. And it's this like collaborative, wonderful experience that really turned me on in terms of like, this is satisfying to me. And so I just kept getting certified. I was like, I just want to know more and more and more and more. And it just continued to expand. So to put it clearly, the Akashic Records is, I use it. So sorry, I said put it clearly, but I always use a metaphor to explain it. So I'm a sports person. I know you'll understand this, but like, you know, in like football games where like you got the players on the field and that's you in your life doing the very best you can with the training that you have, playing live, you know, on the making decisions live on the field, on the court. And then you have your coaches on the sideline, you know, who have a different perspective, but they're lateral with you. You know, they're on the same plane as you and they're giving you advice. Those are your therapists, your coaches, your friends, like anyone who can help you in that supportive way. Mm-hmm. And then there's the people in the booth. Then there's the whole entire staff in the booth, right? Up above mm-hmm. the field, looking down. And to me, that's the best explanation of like that access to that source of information is what the Akashic Records is. It's a, that larger viewpoint of the vibrational record of your existence and all existences. So that quantum zero point field. So a quantum field, that zero point field that they've identified in quantum is like where everything exists all at once, everywhere. Mm-hmm. And the Akashic Records comes from like as far back as the Indian traditions. It's a Sanskrit word, Akasha. It means primary substance. There's a couple different definitions I've found, but primary substance, or I've heard it once, Linda Howe, which from the Linda Howe Center of Akashic Studies, talks about it as the first crystallization of spirit, which is who I first studied with. And so it's this, so that's very spiritual terms, but I like bring it into quantum where it's like, it's a field of energy, a unified field of energy that can be imprinted upon the type of energy that it is. Just like we have different fields of light, like different types of light have different functions and have different properties. Some you can see, some you can't, some are radioactive, some cook food, microwaves, right? Different waves that the Akashic energy field has this unique quality that it can be imprinted upon. And those imprints are of any type of movement of any kind in terms of movement, meaning best way, like everything's vibrating. So any vibration, thought, feelings, emotions, actual existences of action, decisions, all of that is recorded like, you know, like software or like programming of a computer. I was hearing that like talked about. It's like the database, but also the software and the hardware at the same time. So that is the best way that I can try to put it into some terms, because it can get pretty far out there, and that's what I don't like about spiritual work, is that it can get lumped into really ungrounded, very woo-woo, very like out there terminology, even, or it just feels very distancing, when for me the experience is like, this is such a valuable resource that is very practical, that you can, anyone can access, that is just, you know, you want to use it, and then you also want to supplement it with therapy and all of the other like actual things you need, you know, to like move through this life. So that's kind of been my journey. So I just continue to do that. And I started to, like I said, work with others and found that it was useful. And so it became my full-time job. I started a company and I teach now too. I developed coursework with working with the Akashic Records and around creativity and tapping into a flow of all kinds, but your creative flow. And I just finished a 13-month teaching program, teacher training program, that allows me to teach people how to access and create their own structures for accessing their source consciousness of the Akashic Record or beyond, whatever is accessible to them. So that's been the most, I don't think I told you that. Like,
no, that's new to me.
Yeah. So yeah, because I kind of went away for a year. I was like, that's what I've been doing. But yeah, so I just keep kind of trying to want to learn myself. And then it keeps spilling over to, if I can share the 10% I am ahead of someone, potentially like with like a baton, like reach back and like hold their hand and pull them forward. Like, that's how I see what I do in my business.
I mean, I've only had a couple readings from you, and I honestly, I've never had a reading from anybody else, but I would describe it as like, everyone has intuition, and you know, some people are really good about hearing it and listening to it and being like, oh, okay, this is what I think I should be doing next in this scenario. And my experience with you was, majority of what we would discuss would be things that I had already thought about, or maybe I was inclined to think similarly previously, but after like our session, I'd be like, oh, okay, it's not just me. Like, this, that thing that I was thinking about, that is the right way to go. Or maybe that thing that I was thinking is probably not a good idea. It doesn't feel like it's a good, like nothing in it is sitting well with me anymore. So I need to let that go or just pivot a little bit. So I totally get where you're coming from when you're like, oh, it sounds really esoteric and woo-woo and, you know, like out there, when really the functionality of it is very practical. It's very, well, I don't know, maybe it's just because also my session might be very different from somebody else's. So maybe that's a very different bad, but maybe that's a bad example, but that was my experience of it.
No, I don't think it's a bad example at all. I feel like what you're talking about is validation. And I think like for me, that was just my first, I can clearly remember going back to my first experience, like I mentioned, of going to that woman where I was like, Helen von der Heide is her name, by the way. She's amazing. I think she's an incredible leader in the Akashic records and kind of world and expanding that work for her students. But my first experience with Helen was deeply confirming and deeply validating in terms of coming to with questions and being like you just said, like, oh, that is what I thought deep down, like my deep down truth knew that. But to hear it said back to me in a way that resonates so clearly, mm-hmm. the words, like it feels like it's tailored because, and then looking, flashing forward into now, I realize like, because the Akashic Records isn't outside of someone, you're not coming to a session to have your records read, you know, like so that you have to become dependent on someone for that information. The Akashic Records is, like I said before, accessible because it exists currently as a, how do I say this? An experiential record. You know, it's like it's with you. It's the vibrational record of your soul, but your soul is bound in your right. I mean, who knows, who can prove a soul? Try to prove it, but you're having an experience right now as a human. Mm-hmm. And you have qualities and thoughts and values and characteristics that make up that identity. And then, and you have, and I would imagine every human has their challenges that they're wanting to, you know, overcome or learn from or grow from, or they have ambitions or whatever it is. And all of that compendium, all of that, that is who you are, is encapsulated, if you will, like in the Akasha, but it's coming from you. So when I do sessions now, I make sure to say, because I've evolved my work over time, it's like, we're opening the Akashic Records in quotes, like I put air quotes, but really what we're doing is we're tapping into the deepest part of truths of things that you already have access to. So we're just uncovering mostly what's already available to you, but may not be available to you in your conscious, ready mind. That's what I meant about the player on the field. The player on the field can't see that open guy, you know, 20 yards free down the field, or the quarterback would have thrown it to him. So that's why the QB goes and sits and looks at those aerial views and gets a different perspective on his version of what happened so that he can make adjustments moving forward. And to me, that's kind of that relationship that I've used the Akashic Records for. But to make no mistake, like you can open the Akashic Record, you can open the records of a business. You can open the records of a creative project. That's where I found the most exciting and satisfying work is like where I'm like, I'm struggling. I'm like, what does this project need from me? I recently taught a summit and I was like, what am I going to create for this 20-minute talk for this summit? And I was like, mm-hmm. in my own world of using my own brain and I was getting places and I was learning, but then I was like, hold on. I have a resource. Let me open up the records of, you know, this summit and ask, you know, what it wants, which sounds again out there a little bit, but what I realize is what it's doing when I say I'm opening the records, what I'm doing is I'm putting my brain, my prefrontal cortex in a pause mode, mm-hmm. and I'm accessing heart information. I'm accessing more like delta brainwaves where I'm able to find solutions that are different than what I was just hammering away at. It's just an expansive consciousness, expansive way of viewing things. And so that's helpful because mm-hmm. then I got way more clear and I felt, and I don't mean to take away the spiritual part of it altogether because it is deeply spiritual. Like I feel supported every time I feel supported spiritually every time I open the records, regardless if it's for what I want to teach for a summit or I'm in tears being like, what's wrong with me? Either way, I feel supported. Yeah.
Well, I like the way that you just said that last portion of what's wrong with me as you're going through it. Because I feel like a lot of times when people are lurking for teachers or healers or somebody just to give them some sort of guidance. You're always like, the idea is somebody who has it, quote unquote, figured it out. And
no.
Yeah, the older I get, the more I'm like, nope, that is a lie. I have yet to meet anybody who's like, yeah, I got this thing called life, got it down pat. Everyone's winging it. Everyone's just trying to find the way. So, you know, just understanding that and just finding somebody who, I guess, just walks the walk, either that you want to be walking or has something that you're like, oh, I like that aspect. Can I talk to you about this real quick? Because I'm lost, or I'm not feeling very good right now.
Yeah.
And that's not to say that that person is like, I have every facet of my life completely locked down. You know,
cult leaders. Those are cult leaders. I'm not even kidding. Like what you're describing, it's like, who has all the answers? Cult leaders. That's what they sell you. They sell you that they have the answers. And like you said, I think that's so good. Like, I'm going to go to someone and say, hey, like, help me, guide me. And the people who are going to be in your corner are going to turn it back around on you and encourage you to find that structure within yourself. They're going to empower you to have agency and autonomy to find that within. And they're going to help you and give you resources and give you support and have you help yourself, teach you how to fish. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you are in a cult. That's extreme. But you know what I'm saying? Like, those are
that's a great
leaders.
Way to put it.
I have all the answers. I have all the answers. All you need to do is listen to me. Do this, eat this, do that. Let me control all your time. It's like, that is not spiritual in my definition. And I can't, and it's because from the very moment that when I was 5 years old and I got exposed to the Native American, you know, church, they call it a church only because they had to under the government laws to protect them on their sacred ways. So, but like, the Native American ways was like, go in there, sit on your knees, go into the teepee, sit on your knees and sit on the ground, you know, and stare at that fire. I get emotional when I talk about it. It's like, stare at that fire, drink some water, you know, be with yourself, pray. It's like so simple, but it's deeply personal. Mm-hmm. And you're in a circle of people doing the same exact thing. You know, sacrificing a little bit of your time and your energy and your body, not your money, but your body, to a collective for a purpose of, you know, a teepee ceremony always is someone, it's sponsored. There's a reason we're there. We're there to celebrate a birthday. We're there to help someone in need who just needs some support, right? That community support. But you're there with that, but you're also there for yourself, because when you can pray for yourself, you can pray for others, right? And prayer, mm-hmm. Decommissioned or deconstructed from religion, prayer, and I learned it from a little girl, was talk to whatever you feel is your guider, your creator, whatever that looks and means to you. Mm-hmm. Talk to it. You know, mm-hmm. It's there for you. It's not a pre-written thing. And I'm not dogging on anything pre-written. I read scripts and manuscripts because it's like, oh, there's value in all. The information is information. But mm-hmm. I'm just calling out this like unique perspective I had from this indigenous like non-colonial, decolonial way of looking at it, of like, it's you and it's creation and it's whatever it is that you're going to have to learn how to cultivate this for yourself. No one's going to do that for you. We're going to show you different ways, but it's going to be personal. And there's a reason for that. So the autonomy in that, the value in that, I think has such a practical part of my development as a person. And I will be the first to say that there's other parts of me that are so susceptible to cults, like anyone is. And so like, I have literally joined things that are cult adjacent, right? Mm-hmm. Like acting classes that if the teacher was just a little more psycho, would like have definitely been a cult. You know what I mean? Like, luckily we escaped out of that. But so I have that susceptibility. I don't mean I'm not. I just wanted to point that out in terms of what I believe in the work that I do. It's so important to empower and uplift and dignify my clients to know that they don't need to rely on me. And that's why I'm so excited about this new work that I, this teacher training work, because it's like to get to teach someone how to create their own structure. I'm not even creating the structure. I'm not like, here's the words that you need to say to access the Akashic records. I'm saying like, I'm going to guide you through a journey to figure out what is the structure you need. Do you need to sing? Do you need to move? Do you need to just quiet and sit? And like, what's the process that you're going to create for yourself that allows you access to whatever it is that you are going to explore and find what your source consciousness is? You're elevated. You're people in the booth, right? Mm-hmm. You're the version of the spiritual metaphor of the people in the booth. Like, what is that for you? So that you can have it. So that's where I'm like thrilled for this part of my journey. And I'm a terrible marketer. So thank you for bringing me on your podcast and letting me talk about it.
I don't want to oversell my marketing abilities either. This podcast is some.
No.
Times that I'm like, my mom is going to listen to this, maybe, if she has time. That's it. That's my dog would love it.
Does that give you any, like, for me, when I'm on my like Instagram lives and stuff, I'm like, my only like brief, I get like my only like relief is that like nobody's watching. I tell myself, I'm like, nobody's watching. So this doesn't fucking matter. Nobody's watching.
No, for real, especially when I'm editing these, and it's not even about the people that I'm interviewing, because I'm always interested in what they're talking about. But when I hear my own voice, I'm like, the internal dialogue is usually, God, shut up. Shut the fuck up. Why is she still talking?
Aww.
And then, so I usually start like cutting certain things down and just being like, okay, let's skip to the end. Like, we get the idea, honey. But
I think the opposite. I love to hear you talk. I always have. Our production meetings have been like, I just love when you, because you're quiet enough. You really are. And then I'll be like, Mish, what do you think? And you'll sit there and you'll put your hand on your chin and you'll be like, and then you'll like just say this very succinct, like perfect thing like this. And I'm like, that's what we should do. Like, why do any of us talk? You should just be telling us what to do all the time. Be my boss.
It's such a weird thing to have that. But yes, I always struggle with that. But yes, that's how I get through it. I'm like, well, my brother might listen to this and he's going to be the only person. And you know what? He loves me anyways. It doesn't matter. He's still like, good job, sis. Like, okay, thanks, big bro. Like, that's it. And then like randomly I'll get somebody from like another town over, or somebody that I've never met before my life, who will like DM me like, this was great. And I'll be like, oh, wow. Okay. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks, person of the internet. I appreciate that. You know,
but you're growing, right? Oh, sorry.
Like little by little, I had to take a hiatus on it. This is going to be like my second, I'm doing them now in like seasons, quote unquote, because I just could not, I was like, I can either run myself into the ground trying to keep this together and trying to like siphon something together, or I can just be easy on myself and start just trying to get back to what was the point of this. And the point of it was to just stretch myself, and it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. That's what I meant, right? Yeah, that's what I was like saying. Like, it felt like into it just right away. I was like, right, nobody's listening, but like, is that the purpose of, you know, again, that intersection of commerce and whatever, what we're taught, like the extraction, right? That colonial idea of like, you must extract and then produce product. Mm-hmm. Like, this is the way. but when it's like more the process of you. I remember when you were like wanting to start this, and it was like so perfect for you. It's like so such a fit of like what you love doing. Like you said, you like listening to people and you like hearing about others, and you're so you are a great listener. And that piece of made me think like, even regardless of your journey, like your journey in it has to be expanding you, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it has to be. And that's Absolutely. What's incredible about projects of choice. Right. About the I call those any kind of entrepreneur, you know, it's like creative projects are projects of choice. They're like, I'm going to do this. And it's more risky. The entrepreneurial life is more risky. It's like, this might not have payoff in the, again, in the system of capitalism or the system of colonialism. It's like, it might not have payoff, but the gain is so large regardless. Mm-hmm. And like, me and you get to sit and talk like we haven't talked in forever. This is so lovely.
I know. Well, and it's put me like, I think of it as like, for me, if whenever anybody's like, oh, I would love to listen to it, I'm like, sure, here's a link. You may or may not listen to it. I really don't care. But for me, it gives me just one more little sliver of a peg to stand on and be like, I did this. You can't take this away from me. For better or worse, you can think it's shit. That's fine. I don't care. But for better or worse, I'm like, I did something. And unless you're doing something similarly and it's amazing and I really, really like it, I really don't care anymore, which is going back to what we were talking about before, which, in the beginning, you would put something out and you would feel like a whole lot of responsibility for it and ownership of it. And so any critique of that was a critique of you. It's really sadly very recently where I'll put something out and I'm like, you might hate it. And that's okay too. I'm okay with that. You don't need to like me. I like me because guess what? I did that for me. Didn't do it for you. And some of that's
Power,
like, yeah,
power.
it's owning, it's ownership. And I can own it without being like, that's a sensitive part of me. It's like, no, it's not one of the ooey gooey mushy parts that I need to protect anymore. You can have that. And if it causes a reaction to your point earlier of art is meant to give you a reaction, well, that was the point of it, wasn't it? So even if you're like, this is terrible, I hate this. Okay, cool. Go ahead and write about it or put a post on it or whatever. Still talking about it.
Absolutely. I love what you said about the gushy, ooey gushy. How'd you say the gushy,
I don't
ooey
know how
gushy
it
parts
is.
of
Ooey,
you? It
gooey,
was like,
gushy.
what, ooey gooey gushy. But that vulnerability, I feel like what you're talking about is boundaries. It's like you have that self, worth boundary, and you're like, and then this is what I put out. And like, I just thought it was so beautiful the way you said that. Like, I'm not doing it for you. I'm doing it for me. And then, but because you're doing it for you, the ones that you are meant to connect with, or like, I'll say it's the first person, like, because I'm trying to put things out there to build that community, really. It's like, what I put out there is for me personally. What I teach, what I develop is, it's like, well, I need this. So I'm going to do this for me. And if it's helpful for you, great. But when you do share that with that boundary of like, this is for me, when you do make the connection, like you said, that person on the internet reaches out, it's like, you feel seen, and you don't need the validation, but you feel that connection, and that is powerful. And I will say also to the comment of like, I'm doing this. This is something I own and I do. How many people talk about doing a podcast? A lot of people, or talk about moving to LA to be an actor, or talk about producing. People talk about a lot of things, but it's that man in the arena quote. It's like, but you're in it doing it. And unless you're in it doing it with me, bloody and broken and, like bruised up, like you don't really have, like you said, a leg to stand on. And I think that's such a great boundary to understand who is your community and who is not. And what is your metrics for success, right? Because they're personal. I just started reading The Gap and the Gain. Have you read that book? I
No.
just started it. I don't know, Mish, read the introductory and see if you'll like it. But man, it is blowing my mind in terms of perspective shifting in how to measure or be in process with yourself. I just highly recommend it. Like, I'm only ch in chapter two, so maybe by the end of it, I'll be like, ah, I don't know.
Well, it's the gap in the gain.
The Gap and the Gain.
The gap and the gain. I'll write that down.
Yeah. It's so good. So, but that just spurred it to me because it is, they talk about like your internal, I'm not going to try to summarize that book because I'm just barely in it. But yeah, this internal measurement of your own value system and your own kind of what you're measuring yourself up against. Like, what is your versions of these things? Those are the gains. And then if you're looking at like externals and other things, that's the gap. And if you're in that gap, you're not gonna ever feel satisfied. So that's a quick, I said I wasn't going to, and then I tried. But yeah, I think it's great. But just to your point, like, you're doing it, man. Like, you're doing this.
So are
And
you.
that's, yeah.
See?
Well, I came on as a guest.
No, but like, I mean, you also are doing your own workshops, you're teaching. I mean, when I first met you, you weren't doing these things. You had just barely started Akashic. You were on the very beginning of
Yeah,
the journey, at least as far
that's
as I
right.
know.
It's
But
true.
I think that's the interesting part of it. I mean, that's the point of, that's the, even the point of the podcast. That's the interesting part. I'm in, uninterested whether or not you fulfilled your childhood goal of, I said I was going to
Yeah.
be a fireman and now I'm a fireman. I'm more interested. Okay, how did you get there? What was your motivation? Why? Why did you decide to do this? And sometimes it's something really profound, and something's like, well, I liked it. And that can
And
be
that's
that
the
simple.
point that's where I thought this book, I'll just mention it one more time to say, like, that was I thought was so profound about it was like the I want to because I want to without the he specifically trains entrepreneurs. And so it spoke to me very clearly, this part where he was like, when you ask an entrepreneur what they do, they say what they do, and then someone wants to know why. But from the place of like, I think the fr if they're not an entrepreneur or fellow entrepreneur, it's like from the fear place of like, isn't that scary? Like, you have to have a deep, profound reason. Like, you must be really, committed to this. You must be like all 100% in on this ride or die. And it's like, it can be that or it can be anything in between. 'Cause it's like, it may just be, I want to. And the freedom of that without needing to have like, all this other. Because I want to change the world. I want these big, lofty goals, which are wonderful. But at the end of the day, it's like, but what's meaningful to you? And I do wish that, because I've done so many things. Like you ask, that sparks me to think of like when you ask about why and how did you get there. I think about how much money, time, energy I have spent in learning to just try to find out what it is that I want and like. And prefer, and what's my truth? Like, it boggles my mind that I do wish that I had told my younger self, like, hey, maybe don't take every single workshop in the world, and maybe just sit with yourself, maybe just sit with yourself and like ask these like four questions of whatever they are. I don't have the four questions, but I mean, just these like, how are you feeling, and are you okay right now? And if not, like. What do you feel like you could do to take care of yourself a little bit better? And I wish I had like inched away, inched my way forward doing that, because I think I've caused myself a lot of grief wanting, seeing something ex outside of me and being like, oh, that's what it looks like to be perfect. That's what it looks like to be an actor. That's what it looks like to be a this. And so I would follow that, and then it would be a long learning curve. To find out what does it look like for me. And I will say, like, I just recently was reflecting this with our friend Andrew, because I was like, you know what I wish I hadn't done? I wish I had noticed. I wish someone had told me, pay attention who you choose to be your mentors. Because especially in the film industry, I had some bad mentors. Bad. No, and I mean that I'm say I'm calling it out. There are people who do not know what they're doing, and they say that they do, and they have bad intentions, and they're narcissists, and they don't have your best interest in mind. They are not true mentors. I wish I understood more of how to find a mentor and how to see the red flags for someone who is not, because I got a lot of bad information. And I'm so open and susceptible because I wanted it so much. I wanted to be taught. I figured like again, agency, someone outside of me must know better than me because I'm new to this industry. I'm new to this thing. And there's that fine line of finding teachers. And that's why institutions are more useful in certain times because they at least have some type of, validation system that says this. This has been vetted in a certain levels. There's all kinds of other problems with the public education system and institutions, but like at least that with the spiritual things and art, there's anyone can call themselves an actor, just like anyone can call themselves an Akashic Records reader, right? And they might both be true. So there's no empirical validation of some of these things. And so with an industry like that, I would say like, oh, I wish that I had paid attention to who I put my focus on and who I gave my trust to in terms of mentorship, because I had to then unlearn a lot of bad advice. And that if I could cut that down for someone, oh my God, that would be amazing. You know what I mean? Because like, I think it's really damaging. It's the same thing like cult leaders, it's like,
Well, and
so.
I'm just surprised the more that you go through it, the more you meet people, the more you start to like learn what's what, how quickly I'm like, if you just If you learn to listen to that little voice inside of you, you could have really bypassed a whole lot of difficulties when you were younger. But there was just absolutely what there's a comedian once said who was like, you have no gut to listen to. That's why you're so skinny when you're younger. Which I was
Great.
like, that's really funny.
You do, you develop your gut, right? You develop it.
But you do develop that little like
The trusting.
the trust in that of being like, yeah, this doesn't feel right. And it's the same thing of knowing like what is successful. Well, I can't tell you what it looks like because it looks different to everybody, but I can tell you what it feels
Exactly.
like.
Exactly.
Like that
Exactly.
is universal.
And it's so powerful what you're saying right now, because there's and it's so accurate in that, like, I looking back at those mentors, 100% I knew it was wrong. It's like a bad relationship. And everything is relationship, right? Like your relationship to your creative projects, your relationship to your people in your life, but like mentorships, same thing. So it's like a bad relationship. It's like somewhere deep in me was screaming, this is wrong. This doesn't make you feel, it's not good or bad, because right, like just like strength training, like, oh, muscles tearing is like pain, but it's good pain, right? So it's not about like this person's not challenging me, but like there are those levels of this is not coherent, this is not congruent with my values. This is not congruent, this is not meeting me where I'm at potentially, or this isn't, and that's a harder thing to navigate when you're so vulnerable wanting to have someone help you get a leg up. And that's where I think the onus is calling out some of these personalities and people who are taking advantage of that. And that is not okay. And it might not even be your money. I had mentors who didn't want money from me, but it still was like time and like, what can you do for me? Later on, like favor exchanges, those hierarchies are not mentorship. Like a good mentor does not claim their hierarchy over you, because a good mentor will expect you to surpass them. I mean, Star Wars didn't have it all wrong. You know what I mean? It's like, it's like I think so. So I think that's the one thing I'm reflecting on as of late, of like who I listened to and how much I that cult thing, like how much I went into, oh, they have all the answers. And what that does immediately is it shuts off your internal system to be able to listen to your own answers. And so I think a good mentor will awaken your own internal system. They will awaken you to be able to trust more of your own internal system, not less.
Absolutely, 100%. I've never actively, I shouldn't say never, but I rarely sought out quote unquote mentors like strategically. It was always somebody came along and we ended up developing that sort of relationship.
Same.
Yeah, and just like you, sometimes like the advice was great and sometimes it was bad, but thankfully I've only attracted the narcissist romantically. It was only one area of my life of my life, but
Oh, that's so rough.
I
That's
know,
so rough.
right?
Oh, God.
It's rough no matter what arena you end up dealing with them and letting them
It's
into
true.
your personal space. No matter what you do, it's a rough lesson. So I don't envy
Yeah.
anybody who goes through that. I've been there and I'm so sorry. But
Yeah.
I've, but for mentors, like, I mean, even if they mean well, sometimes it's like that advice did shit for me. Or it works for you. You're a different personality than I am.
Yes.
Does not work for me.
Yes.
And just learning that along the line is it's incredibly helpful once you figure that out. But yeah, if
Well,
anybody else, yeah.
discernment, right? Like that's a skill that I wish I'd cultivated, or someone had said point blank to me, had used that word. Hey, work on your discernment. Like, what do you need to be able to discern what is right and wrong? Your filtration system. And I think when I look at the themes of my life, I think that that is one thing, even from design school all to acting to producing to like all of it, it's like, oh, filtering down to simpler is not my strong suit. Like the best designers get it pared down regardless of the style of design. They the simplicity of it is present. The essence of it is there because they've distilled or able to filter out all the bullshit that didn't matter. I do not have that skill set. I'm like add, keep adding more and more and more. Like I would be like the version of like Gaudi. Like it's like oh God, so like beautiful,
Keep adding.
but yeah. But discernment, right? Discerning for yourself and then discerning what is. Good for you, you know, help what helps you on your path and what doesn't. And I haven't got that far in the book yet for the gap and the gain, but my friend relayed that one of, oh, actually, I did just read that on the way home. Actually, I was listening to it in the car, but as an audiobook, but they talked about the British rowing team in, I don't know what year, the 90s, that they picked up this, adopted this philosophy. That they wanted one metric that all everyone could turn to and ask this question to be able to discern decision making for themselves as a team. And the question was, will this make the boat go faster? So if they're getting invited out to a party, the story that he example he gives in the book is if they're getting invited out to a night out before practice the next morning, to know whether or not you're going to say yes or no to that party invitation is like, will this make the boat go faster? You know? And like, and they won gold. They ended up winning gold, and that's what why it's publicized because they actually did follow through, and it made, you know, it made a visible metric that you can follow and say, see, at least that worked for them. But I think universally, it's a cool concept to what is your measurement of version of what will make the boat go faster? And I'm just picking up this information, so I'm like really excited to see like how my discernment might be able to grow from this concept. So I thought I would add that.
I do love that. I think that's something you can use for anything. And I think that's something that, I mean, that's the trick of it, isn't it? Is figuring out one, what do you want to do? And then two, what will make the boat go faster? What will make you get there faster, no matter what that is? And how can you do that while not hampering in on anything like your morals or being a good person or you know, those key tenets of still keeping a good person intact while also getting you to that finish line. Because you know, to your point of the bad mentors, well, they might have been really good at their craft, but if they're shit human, then I don't necessarily want to be in your realm.
Absolutely.
Anyways.
Absolutely. And the truth of what you're saying, like a good human, like the truth of you. And I think the other piece of advice that I would give myself, oh my gosh, if I was 18 or 20 and I could give this to my 20-year-old self, fuck, I would be so happy to receive this. Cause I started doing life design in the last 5 years. And it's the principle like assessment. One of the pieces of life design is like personal assessment. Look and articulate for yourself what are your values? Write them out. Choose from a list. Like I taught this class. It's like it's so powerful to be like, what do I actually believe is like the guiding principles of life? Like, what is your work view? What is your view of work? What is your life view? What do you think about the way life is? Where do you go when you die? What do you ask these personal questions of yourself? Write them down. Assess like the areas of your life. And there's so many tools now that you can do with this. It's not just personality tests. Like there's so many different ways, like life assessment, type it in and see what comes up. There's worksheets because it's like when you start to look at like how do I feel about where am I in work, love, play? Where am I in those categories? You know, that's like life design. They teach it at Stanford. It's like, what are those? There's a book on it that you can get for these two guys who taught it for Stanford for years and then wrote a book. But beyond that too, it's like there's other ways of assessment. It's like category, like where do you feel like you are spiritually? Like 1 to 10, or like, you know, where are you in relationships? Where are you in money? Where are you in these categories of your life? Like, how do you feel about you? What are your invisible scripts? Like this deep assessment work, I feel it's not for everybody, but I do feel like that what I would tell my 20-year-old self is like, do that work and know that it's not final. Right? Like you're going to do that work when you're 20 right now when you're 20, little girl, and then you're going to like keep doing that work. Keep finding out what's true for you. Keep mining for what it is you, where you're at and what you need and what you want, and keep doing that, because that's your baseline. Otherwise,
Right.
you're going to go with others. And that's kind of what I did, you know? Like, I kind of made decisions that I don't think were fully fleshed out from my place of deep awareness, because I hadn't done self-assessment. Because I didn't really know what I stood for. I didn't really know where my morality, like you said, my morality was, where what I really, what were some boundaries. And then I think I would just judge myself on a lot of things that didn't matter to me either, because I didn't know that. And so then I'm just living a life that's like, feels very, like you said earlier, like kind of lost and unsure. I'll still feel that way, but at least you'll have some tangible metrics that matter to you that you can kind of return to help you guide you.
We'll do a little bit of a shift. If someone is looking for like more information about you, because you are doing these workshops and you do your readings, and it sounds like you've really been jumping in both feet, which good for you, girl. Because
Well, I'm developing. I'm in development right now. Right when you like work in production, I'm not in pre-production. I'm in pre-production slash coming out of development. That's where I'm at right now.
aren't
That's
we
where a lot of
all?
the stuff.
Aren't we all? Any day now, I'm going to be in production. If someone wanted to learn more about you and they wanted to get some information, maybe get a reading or anything, where would they go to?
Yeah, I have a website. So it's revealyourlight.com and it's reveal-your-light.com. That's where you can book sessions with me. You can read a little bit about my, not definition, but my explanation of an Akashic Records session and the Akashic Records. I do need to update that, I realize, but right now it's a version. It's a version. It's in development. So that's where they can find me. Also, primarily I'm on Instagram at the Kiara Maya, Chiara Maya dot or not dot com. Kiara Maya. The Kiara Maya. And I don't have any business Instagram or anything. I just use that. And I do say Instagram primarily because I'm not so much on, I have profiles on Facebook and Twitter, and I think I might have a TikTok, but no, I don't really. So yeah, so DM me on Instagram was the point. If and that's another way to get a hold of me, to understand how I can maybe facilitate some clarity or allow you to, navigate your lives in a more aligned way. So that's what I like to do.
I have a TikTok, but I don't really use it to put content out, even though I really should. But there's just so many other things that I could be
Oh
doing.
yeah, I'm very intimidated by TikTok. I use my nieces actually to filter for me. So they send me things they think I would like, and I just don't go on there because the genius of that attention economy grabber, where as soon as you get on, the volume and the thing is going, the video and the volume is going. It's like, it immediately hits all your senses. And I mean, I watch a lot of television and I watch a lot of movies because it's what I love. So I get sucked in super easily. I have since I was like super young. Ask anyone in my family, if the television is on, I am that asshole person where like I will get so involved that you could be talking to me and I am not there with you. I am inside the television on that show. Like and people are like, Kiara, 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 Kiara. And I'm like, oh, were you talking to me? Like, I just have this ability to get like so wrapped up. And social media is obviously, we are the product, right? We are the user, we are the addict that they want to keep hooking. So TikTok intimidates me a lot because of that. But reels are the same now. I'll get on Instagram reels and just be lost for, unfortunately, at least 45 minutes.
Oh yeah, no, they do that by design. You're not alone by that, by the way, with that, because I will intentionally put myself away from a TV if I'm in a bar or something and I'm
Me
there with
too.
other people, because otherwise I'm like, I'm sorry, I will be half looking at you and half trying to follow whatever plot of whatever TV show, even if it's terrible. And I'm like, I don't like that show. I don't like that movie. But here I am. I'm sucked in, and I've watched it before, maybe. And I'm like, I know what happens, and I'll still be like, wait, this is a good part.
Oh, it's the same. I'm the same with sports. I used to be
Oh.
so much worse with sports. Oh my God, I've grown so much, or at least moved away from this. But in college, when I was dating, like, guys would make the mistake of bringing me to like a sports bar during the playoffs of like
Oh.
basketball. And I would just be like, bro, like, I'm not concentrating on you at all. Like, I only care if Garnett is going to hit this next like bucket to put them up by two. Like, what is happening right now? And I feel so bad because they don't know, like, not, that's tip the stereotype of like women aren't that into sports. Like, oh, wrong. You brought me to the wrong place, bro. I've gotten
Same.
so much better now. I've gotten a little bit better now, but even still, like, it's just like, it doesn't even matter what team. It's just like live games are, and I don't even follow it that closely anymore, so it's funny.
No, I don't follow as much as I used to. Like, football used to be like my thing, and now I
Yeah, me
just
and you both, we had that, it was just right, other priorities. I realized I had changed as a person, Mish. I don't know if you relate to this. I'm so curious if you're where you are in your journey of it. I realized I had fundamentally changed as a person when I was doing something on a Sunday and I realized, like, oh, it's Sunday and it's fall. And I had no idea that football was even on. I didn't even register that it was Sunday and there was football on. And I was like, this used to be like the quintessential identifier for me. It was like, what would I be doing on Sundays? Would be like NFL schedule was my schedule. So I
Oh yeah.
realized, I'm like, wow, I have shifted as a person. Like, this is a marker. Whoa.
I just had that moment actually. I usually the first game of the Charger season, I will make sure that I am there, right there, right before kickoff. And I've been working on a project and I just got pulled in, and it's one of those things. It turned into a late night, and before I knew it, I looked up and I'm like, oh my God, I missed the majority of the game. That never happened to me before. Like, a few years ago, I've been like, that's on my calendar. It's all right. Click off. I gotta go watch the game. I'm done. Done for the day. Don't talk to me.
Yeah.
And now
Yeah.
I was like, wow, okay. This is like the next day, my coworkers were like, so how was, how about that game, that play? And I'm like, I actually missed it.
I have like shame over it. It's so weird. I'm like, I would like, as I was transitioning out over the last couple of years, like I stopped doing fantasy football. I like stopped watching like basketball, and like just over the years, like I started watching more television. I started getting more involved in acting, and so, but I had like shame over it when people, because people knew I'm such a big sports brand. They're like, "How about the Giants? Like, what do you know?" And I'm like, I don't even know who's on the team. Like, and I would like not even say that because I'd be ashamed to not know. And at the same time, I just recently got to go and watch the Giants play live against the Dodgers, unfortunately. But meaning we lost.
Unfortunately.
But I got to go to the stadium, and or I mean to the park and watch, and it was so fun. Like, that's never gonna leave me, you know what I mean?
No.
Like, I love sports. It's such a huge part of me. I think it's been a huge part of my development. When you ask about like this podcast being like, where, how did you do what you did and why? I think sports, the influence of sports and team sports and the way that that training and that environment made me think about work and play and achievement and systems of structure in terms of collaboration, and like so much of my influence of who I am is from sports. And so that's never gonna go away, but the fan part of me has, I'm ashamed to say, like dwindled.
It used to be such a big part of my identity that it is weird for me as well to be like, oh, I don't not following like I used to, and I used to be so invested in this, and
Yeah.
just life happened. But
Yeah, it's interesting though too, because I realized, like, I wonder if we would, if we took that fandom, because fandom's such a specific thing. And I, hearing you talk, that's how I was. I would miss shit to go to a Niner game. You know what I mean? Like, I would make sure that I, like you said, I would make sure I watched every play because I was invested and I loved it. And so it's an interesting perspective to think. I wonder if we took that same like love and enthusiasm and shifted it into like something else, you know, that dedication. Like, it's so, I don't know what created the dedication to the sports team for me though. Like, I can't remember a time when I didn't care whether the Niners beat the Raiders, you know, like I can't tell you, like, I just never didn't care. I can't remember what caused that kind of care and dedication and involvement. And like the thing about a fan that I think some people outside of sports don't get is like that journey that a team takes you on and the way in which you invest because you feel like you're a part of it. And it, like, people make fun of it, but like when you're inside it, it's so special.
Yep.
You know what I mean? It's so special, and it is a journey, and it's a ride, and it's like, it is storytelling. It's live action storytelling, like in the real live action world, because it's like games happen, two teams play each other, it actually goes down, and then there's an outcome, right? And it's so satisfying in this, like, you know, social media, like whatever world where everything can be, you know, one way or another kind of faked or made a version of, where it's like these things happened. So it's attractive. And I wonder if, like, we ever, either of us, as we're transitioning out, with like, are just transferring that to another thing, or like, I don't know.
I always wrap up my conversations with four very simple, very abstract kind of questions. So I'll just do those real quickly and then we'll wrap it up. Okay. What is your favorite sound?
Oh, my husband has this little giggle. It's a very specific kind of giggle that when I make him laugh and he thinks something's funny that I've said, and it's like, hee hee. And I live for that sound.
That is the most endearing thing I think I've heard yet. What is your least favorite sound?
My sister's crying when they're heartbroken or when they're hurt. Yeah, I don't like to hear that sound at all. Any of my family being in pain is really hard.
What is your favorite word?
Fuck.
It's a fun one. I like that one. What is your least favorite word?
Well, it's a phrase. I told you so. Yeah, that always really hurts. Even if I tell it to myself, you know, it's harsh. No matter what way you get to, you dish it.
Yeah, that's a tough one. It's almost like a taste in your mouth. I'm like, oh yeah, I remember that one.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Well, last one, you already answered it, because I was going to ask what's your favorite curse word, but.
Actually, I have a phrase for that. When I get, this is so bad. when I get really frustrated with something, I'll say, I don't even know if I can't do it unorganically. Let me see. It's a phrase that I run together, and it's something to the effect of, I wish I could get mad for a second. Sometimes something really funny, I'm like, son of a fucking whore. Like it's so bad, but it's something like that. It's like something like it's weird that I can't call it up, because it happened. Like, it's my automatic default.
You got to be in the moment. You got to be in that, yeah, that emotional state.
Yeah, exactly. But it's something of like, son of a fucking.
That's okay. I say everything, something, puto gets somewhere put in some sort of sentence. If I'm really, really pissed off, it's like, fucking puto. Like, and I'm like, I don't use that word normally. Even when I'm speaking Spanish, like, I don't use it really well, but yeah, if I'm pissed.
My dad, we all in my family know this, because he has that one. He has that go-to, and he's a Spanish speaker, but he'd go, mierda, like that. And you knew if you heard that, oh, he was in deep into a car part that wasn't working, or into a hose that was tangled, or like, it was just so intense.
Reminds me of my grandfather. He used to say that every now. My grandfather had the worst potty mouth ever. Like, my brother and I both, I'm pretty sure, learned our curse words through him.
I love it. The things they pass down to us.
The gems, I will say, the important gems that you will need. Well, that wraps up the interview. I'm sorry, we totally went over. So thank you so much for giving me your
time. Oh my
time.
God. No, thank you. I kind of had that feeling, but it was such a good conversation. I'll take it. Like I said, we haven't talked in a while, so this was lovely. And I'm so happy to support just you, like we said earlier, being in the arena and doing this. I'm so grateful you asked. So yeah. Anytime.
Of course. Thank you. Thank you.
Hey, And we are going to leave it there. If you are interested in following Kiara's pursuits and also enjoy really cute pics of her dog, you can follow her at Kiara Maya on Instagram. That's C-H-I-A-R-A-M-A-Y-A. If you want to look into that book that she mentioned, I have a link to it in the show notes. That is The Gap and the Gain. Lastly, if you want to look into getting a bird's eye view of your life or a project after hearing this episode, head on over to revealyourlight.com to book a reading. That is also in the show notes. At the very least, I hope this has inspired you to remember that we are all in development, and usually the worst critic you will ever meet is the one staring at you in the mirror. My name is Michelle McAllister, and this is the Jack of No Trades podcast. Thank you for listening.